Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minnick. I am the host of the Behavior Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Timothy Harrington. Tim is the founder and chief empowerment officer of Family Addiction Recovery Services and Sustainable Recovery Services, and then finally the co-founder of the Wide Wonder Zero Stigma Education Services. Throughout this episode, Timothy will be getting into his awesome and amazing recovery story, as well as he persevered throughout his obstacles to get to the place he is today. We will also get into different types of stigmas the general public have with people going through addictions. So without further ado, let's get started. Tim, man, thanks again for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking me. I love doing this stuff, so I appreciate it.
Again, I know we're going to have a great time. I know you're a man of many tales, and I'm super excited to go on this journey with you, man.
Yeah, let's do this, man. I'm, you know, as I think it's a country song, or maybe it was turned into a country song, because I'm not here for a long time. I'm here for a good time.
I love it. And just like stories and everything, man. Like, you know, what's your story and how you got into this, like, behavioral health field, as we say?
Yeah, so my path was not unlike many's path who end up, you know, transitioning into the helping profession, if you will. I was mobile homeless, I like to call it, driving up and down PCH in Southern California. Lots before that, but this was sort of like the precipitating event before I got into what is this stretch of what I call discovery. I'm a human becoming, I like to say. So I'm just kind of, I'm unfolding, you know what I mean? And I don't know where things are going to go. I'm not in the predicting business. I'm trying to be in the moment, you know, like a lot of us are. We're just trying to be in the moment and see what happens. And so I got back here in 2001, and I was still trying to figure it out and trying to come up with a plan. Many, many, many plans before that. This was the new, the new one. And oh my God. So I'm laughing and getting chills at the same time as I recall this time in my life. So I'm driving up and down PCH, because if I'm going to be mobile homeless, it's going to be in Malibu.
Yep.
I mean, come on. Seriously. Right. I mean, there's a lot of homeless folks in Southern California, and I know why. I mean, I totally get it. It's sunny in 72. I don't have to worry about cold of Minnesota or, you know, I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. So I'm managing, I think, really well at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm back to where it's sunny in 72 and I can, that at least is not a wild card situation. So I'm driving up and down PCH and I'm stealing stuff from CVS, like insurers, just to stay nourished and trying to figure it out. And I get a call from a guy who says, "Hey, I heard you were living in your car." And I can't remember at this point, like, who I've told, like, how my story is getting out there. I found out later that this person had called my mother. She's the hub of this, of everything, you know? And, so anyway, he calls, he says, "I hear you doing this and what's going on?" And I said, "Oh no, everything's fine." And then I managed that person. And then I get another call, who apparently that person called and said, "Hey, I hear you're living in your car. Come live with me in Los Feliz," which is East LA. "And got a place there, got a room, you don't need to live in your car." And he used to work for me. He used to be actually a waiter at my restaurant. So I was like, all right, cool. So I go. And at this point, I'm thinking about AA because I went to treatment and then was familiar with Westside LA AA. And so, but I'm driving around it, right? And so.
Is this a dangerous area? Is this like a pretty
East
dangerous-
LA?
Yeah.
No, actually, it's sort of the old, it's the original Hollywood. It's where Griffith Park Observatory is, which is where they shot Rebel Without a Cause, and lots of old, beautiful homes, you know, before sort of Hollywood. It moved actually west. So that's the interesting migration of Hollywood. It sort of was always on the cusp of being at East LA, even like where all the, you know, stars on the Walk of Fame and stuff. If you go not very much farther, you're kind of in East LA. So it's a nice area. It's still sort of in transition, I would say, because now it's way, way more expensive. Well, everything is more expensive here, but it was still a cool area. It had plenty of donut shops, which was cool with me. Nice. So I moved in with this guy, and he was still sort of running and gunning and doing drugs and stuff. And so I'm like, barricaded in his room while him and his, his producing buddy are all like doing lines and smoking, pot and going out and partying in LA and doing that scene. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm stressed out. What am I going to do? So finally, I decided I had a plan. So what I did is I bought a bucket of paint and I painted my room blue.
Oh, all right.
Because blue is calming, right? I'm
Yep,
doing
okay.
all this as a way to calm myself, right? Like now I have a refuge where the walls are blue and I can be
That's
calm,
awesome.
right? So I'm doing all this stuff, right? And so, finally I had reached sort of an apex of anxiety. I wasn't sleeping very well, and at this point I'm smoking and drinking a lot of coffee and eating a lot of sugar. And that all makes perfect sense if if you know what kind of things you're experiencing post-acute withdrawal,
And
right?
you're still staying sober at this time, right?
I am.
The
I am. I'm
lines are
staying.
not persuading you. The okay.
No, they're just pissing me off,
Yeah.
basically, because it's not really where I want to go. I've got at this point, 20 years of that road, and I'm like, I need a different road. I need a different solution. And so I'm doing this, and I'm trying to figure out how to do that without going back to AA, because I just don't want to do that. So ultimately, it runs its course. And I get in my car one day, completely stressed out and very angry and just, dysregulated. And I drive to the west side and I go to a meeting. Dude, I mean, it was insane. I'm sitting out on the front steps and this girl walked up to me and I know I can clock her. If she's coming toward me, she's going to say something. I'm like, I don't want to talk to this
Right.
person at all, not even a tiny bit. And so she comes up, she goes, hi, my name's Natalie. And and I'm like, oh, hello. And she's like, will you read chapter 5? And I'm thinking, oh my God, really? And I'm 40 pounds underweight. I'm color blue gray. I'm not doing fantastic and feeling good or confident or any of that. And then, but something inside of me just kicked and I was like, yeah, I can't let Natalie down. So I'm like, yeah. So I read, and at this specific place, it's been a meeting place for like, I think 50 years at this point. And it's called The Last House on the Block, and it's 26th and Broadway in Santa Monica. And so in this place, the ceilings are really low. This is an old house. It's probably the early 1900s. And so the ceilings are low. And even on these low ceilings, they have these track lights. They're like this far from your face, right? And I'm already sweating. And so I get up there and I'm literally like bead sweat, just down and trying to get through chapter 5. And what felt like 6 days, was finally over and people clapped. They're clapping. I'm like, what did I do? I don't even remember it hardly, right? So anyway, now they're clocking me, right? So I'm really fucked because I know what's gonna happen at the end of the meeting. I'm gonna be surrounded, and I just, oh, like there's this coffee cup that says, I don't want to go outside. It's too people-y out there, right? So anyway, so they do come up to me, and this guy gives me his card, and he becomes my sponsor, and it's Boston Bob, and he's a classic character. And I'd actually met him a long time ago before when I was in going to meetings just out of treatment. And so that was an easy transition because I knew the guy. So I'm like, yeah, cool. He was a cool guy. So I'm like, yeah, I'll meet you, whatever. Now I'm driving from East LA to West LA and doing that migration to go to these meetings because I feel comfortable there. I've gone to a couple over there. In the meantime, I went to a atheist meeting. I went to a treatment center meeting. I went to a few meetings and it just wasn't my jam. So I go to what I'm used to because it's less stressful, right? So anyway, I do that, and then I get a year under my belt just to kind of speed it up a little bit. But it was great because I met a group of guys and we ran together, and it was about five of us. And I think one day we went to one, two, three, four, five, six, seven meetings in one day or something, including the midnight meeting on Melrose, which is a good way to cap off a day of meetings because it's you never know what's going to happen there.
So can I ask you, are these just like recovery support meetings, or are they somewhat AA affiliated? Because I know you said you wanted
Yeah,
to expand.
there's thousands of AA meetings here, so you can go at you start at 6 and go to midnight. And so it was, and we're just running all over the place because we're like a pack, right? We're not really clued into what it's all about. We're all just, doing the best we can. And so, yeah, it's AA. It's AA all day, every day. And I think I went to 270 meetings in 90 days.
Wow, because they usually
So
just bring from
minimum
90
of
to
three.
90.
Yeah, I'm not doing, I'm going overboard. I'm going to go further.
Yeah.
So I did at least three meetings. So it's a little more than that, but I always just round it off. So it was three meetings a day for 90 days and got a sponsor, did this, that, and the other thing. And then somewhere in there, somebody said I should work in treatment. So that's how I get around to this whole, like, 'cause I tried working in restaurants. That's a cool story. I actually waited on Nicolas Cage, and
Nice.
Nicolas Cage came in at noon and started drinking with impunity. I felt like acne
Wow.
because he was drinking my drink, like vodka on the rocks and my
Yeah.
favorite brand. And I'm like, this is a bullshit test, dude. I'm like, what is going on here? You got to make it this guy. You got to make it this brand. You got to make it this way of drinking it.
Yep.
And I'm still irritable, restless. I'm still stark raving sober. And because, you're just still wet behind the ears. You don't know shit. You're just trying to, do the best you can. And so I leave and I go into the waiter station, like in where your locker is. And I open the locker and I scream in the locker.
Yeah. Wow. Yell it out.
I let it out, but it echoed pretty good. And management came back and they were like, I don't know what's going on with you, bro, but make this your last day. Well, anyway, I'm out of that job. So I start networking. I get a job working for the lady who produces the VH1 show Behind the Music. I don't know if
Okay.
you ever heard of it.
Yep.
One of my favorite shows of all time. Love that show. And so I'm like, yeah, I'll work there. And I'm basically a glorified step and go fetch it. So I'm just delivering
Gopher.
stuff all over. I'm a gopher. And one day I was like, I think I'm going to tell somebody what I think about how things are run around here. So I shoot off an email and my sponsor gives me a call, and I have a new one at this point. He's like, really, bro? This is what you're. And so the message comes down on high. This is probably not going to work. So that's another job. So I'm pretty disheartened at this point. And somebody says to me somewhere at a meeting, maybe you should, have you ever thought of working in treatment? And I like to joke. I like to say, like, I'm not sure if that was a compliment or an insult. Still not yet.
Yeah.
And so I end up going. You have to be a year. So it was June. I think I actually got the job and I started working in treatment. And that really launched me into where I am today, which is, helping families. Because
Yep.
what I realized along the way, and I was a sober companion. So I flew around the country. I went.
Wow.
I did a lot of really cool things. I met some amazing people. And but what I realized at the same time, because I was wondering why this was even a position, and I wondered why people pay so much for it, because really all I'm doing, I'm not really doing much. It's not much you can do, because everybody has the right to self-determine and they'll drink if they want, and I'm not wrestling anybody over a bottle of fucking whiskey, I'll tell you that right. Because I'll lose.
You would know,
I would lose, right? I mean,
yeah.
I'm not getting in there. And so I started thinking about, like, I'm wanting to know more about stuff. And so I heard of a guy named William White. And William White is a educator who has been doing research. I don't know if your audience knows who they are, if you do, but he is an educator who has been researching recovery since the 60s.
Okay.
And he is amazing. And I recommend everybody go to williamwhitepapers.com and learn about William, because we owe him a lot of gratitude, because he has really worked his ass off. I think he's like almost 80 now and semi-retired, but he said we're focused on the pathology, the disease. That's where all the money goes. That's where all the research money
Yeah.
goes. That's where, and he was like, I don't know if that's, I think we need a balance here, because there's a lot of data, not just people who go to treatment, because that's not everybody who gets recovery, right?
Yeah.
You got 23 million people who are in a state of remission from substance use disorder in the United States, and 2 million in AA. Now, I don't know how many people went through there, but an amount of people did. But when you have 23 million people, people are getting sober and staying sober for in a lot of different ways, right? Many pathways, right? So the top of my head blew off because nobody knows this.
Right.
This is not information that's passed around. We don't want that necessarily because the business really sort of is in a lot of ways is driven by fear, right? Like a thousand forms of fear, like I was, like fear of not getting what I want or losing what I have, right? So if you're a treatment center, you're pretty self-centered. You're running on self-centered fear, right? And you're thinking, isn't this, and I was thinking, isn't this ironic?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And I'm like, wow. And I get chills. I'm thinking, man, all these things started to get really, like the puzzle pieces started coming together. And the more information I knew about recovery and all of this research that was out there that, you know, that really doesn't fit the business model necessarily, you know, recovery oriented systems of care and how do we keep people engaged for longer strength based interventions and long-term support and not everything being about, you know, stay away from people, places and things, all kind of playing defense, you know? And I'm like, I'm a sports guy. I played soccer for years and I love football. I love all kinds of sports because I love the dynamic and I love the intensity and the commitment to winning and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And I think, man, you have to have sort of a balanced approach. I know defense wins championships, but you know, that even in of itself is a very, there's a strong commitment because you have a whole side that plays offense. So you have to figure out with your personnel what's going to get you the outcome you're looking for. Right. Yeah. So when I think about where I've come in terms of, you know, my own struggle with, you know, an understanding with context after many years down the road and really wanting to understand, you know, what made me, like all the different pieces and all the different experiences and all the different traumas and all the different people I met and all the different things I learned and the jobs I had and the places I lived. Like it all matters, you know, and as I'm going through, I'm trying to compartmentalize. I'm throwing that out. That's a throwaway. You know what I mean? I don't want to talk about that. You know what I mean? I want to cherry pick, you know?
Well, that's one like actually pretty good, cool thing that I like about AA and NA is the groups and the camaraderie, the fellowship is like when you're there, you kind of learn from other people's stories. And what I always tell people, especially even in my groups, it's like, you don't have to agree with everything I say, but if you could take little bits and pieces that you can apply to your life, that's good, man. Like
take what you want.
Yeah.
Leave the rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because that actually, that means, that creates room for folks, right? I've always, as I've changed the way that I've interacted and seen AA based on everything I've studied and all the history and not just the history of AA, but the history of around AA and what was going on, what was driving these movements of, you know, the drunkard society, you know, like, you know, what, you know, in the history of like William White wrote a book called Slaying the Dragon, and it's our history of using substances for as far back as we know. And it's important, that context is important, because if we don't have it, we'll develop policies that make shit worse, right? We'll develop drug policy that actually makes it worse. If our drug policy was so great, why are things worse after 50 years of intense prohibition? It's actually more than that, because the Harrison Tax Act was really the thing that started prohibition, which was starting to regulate heroin.
Right.
So you talk to people in treatment, you talk to people in this business, and 90% of people have no idea why they exist, right? As a profession or as an entity. There's no connective tissue. There's no appreciation for journey. There's no appreciation for the reason why we decided that this was the way we should do it. Right? No matter how, when we look at the outcomes and the data, we can clearly see there's room for improvement. So we got this far based on this. And I think to myself, now going back to the sports metaphor, are we really satisfied with a 6-12 record?
Yeah, exactly.
Are we really, right? Are we really satisfied with a 2-10 or whatever we're like, really, guys? I don't see it. I don't get it. I think it's head in sand. I think it's that intolerance for being uncomfortable, you know, which is also at the base of everything that we do in terms of how we decide to cope with shit,
Yep.
right? So I, you know, that's the reason why I became this outlier. You know, I remember it very distinctly when I was like, okay, you know, I'm gonna start talking about this shit.
Well, one thing I've noticed about you, Matt, is you have a voice. Just like how you're talking about your other jobs, you have passion, you have a voice, and you want to speak your mind. And that's is just gonna rub people the wrong way sometimes, but fuck it, who cares?
Well, it does. And again, with context and history, everybody has a hero that spoke their mind,
Yeah.
right? We all do. It just, we picked the one that, you know, spoke my mind, like that I
Right.
related to, right? So our heroes are also on point because we're identifying with them in some way. We're like, oh, yeah, that's so true. I get that. I feel
Yes.
that. I want to know more about that, you know? And that's what happens too in the groups. And I love what you said, because I think, you know, what the data tells us is that the best and most positive and most amazing thing about mutual aid support groups is the community, right? And
It's
the more we
beautiful.
make room for folks and go back to what the original intent of AA was, which was a ragtag group of people who didn't want to have rules, who changed them to suggestions from rules because the Jeffersonians and all the other sort of really, you know, hang on one second. Alexa, stop timer. The world we live in. But anyway, you know, that rigidness, you know, and that today has really served me very well, because psychological flexibility based on meta studies in terms of what helps us move forward and function optimally is psychological flexibility, is to be able to be flexible, right? Not rigid.
Now, going back to like the traditions of AA, and it kind of goes back to your rigidity, is that why? I think it's more just fear in our society of people doing recovery in a different way than it was originally not intended. And that's the sad thing I feel like about AA is like you're right. It started one way, and I feel like it's just totally different now as time goes on. It's become a lot more judgmental. And people, I'm not saying all AA meetings or NA meetings are like this. Some are pretty bad. They're very extremely judgmental, and that's not what Bill W. would have wanted. And it's
No,
changed.
it has changed because things change. It's the only constant, right? So that's what I mean about giving room and being able to evolve. And I'm an evolutionary, so I don't want to be stuck somewhere. I've already been stuck somewhere. I don't want to be stuck anymore. I want to be in a flow. You know what I mean? And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be an ex I don't like, I don't trust experts. I want to be, you know, I want to be a specialist, which means I really focus on things and I have some knowledge, just enough to be dangerous, but I want to honor the fact that I am only, what I know is only in the scope of what I know. There's much more, right? I can only know so much, no matter how much I know. You know what I mean?
It's amazing, man. And I kind of compare it to like the finish line of recovering goals. If I get to the finish line one way and you get to another way, who gives a shit?
Yes,
Who cares? Like,
right, exactly. We all get to sit back and celebrate everyone crossing the finish line, no matter how they got there.
yes. Yep.
Like, you think about people's training regimen. Like, we actually laud people for their particular proclivity to how they coach, right? Not everybody coaches the same. Belichick coaches different than,
Yes.
you know what I mean? Like, it's, but that's like, you take your foundation and your foundation's Lombardi, but you don't coach exactly like Lombardi,
Yeah.
right?
Exactly.
You
Be you.
develop your own style. Yeah.
Like, I can't
And
do
that's
things the way
beautiful.
you do it. If I try to do things the way you do it, I'm gonna fail.
And that means you're not you. You should just
Right.
do you.
Yep. Hell yeah.
On. Like, there's a
Oh.
great saying. One of my favorite sayings is, be yourself. Everyone else is already taken.
Yes. Yep.
Right? That's it. But we live in a society that says the opposite, that pressures you to conform. It pressures you to go along. It pressures you to aspire to certain things. And this is stuff that's getting worked out based on evolution, right? Based on how we change, based on how events in our lives change, like the pandemic. The pandemic has changed recovery. It'll never be the same. We can't go back. We shouldn't go back. We should appreciate it for what it's done and run with that shit, right? Like, I mean, these are gifts. They're things that teach us things. They're not punishments. They're not things to do anything except go, what am I going to do with this? Like, how am I going to innovate? Like, this is an opportunity to innovate. I'm being challenged right now. It's not happening at me. You know what I mean? It's happening for me. And I get in perception, and that psychological flexibility is everything. That allows me to take that, look at it in a way that doesn't get me stuck or knock my ass back 20 steps. You know what I mean?
I also really think it's the concept of change where most people view change as a bad thing. And that could be from like past traumas, experiences, like change is bad, change is bad. So when you get
Change
COVID,
is bad.
a lot of times people had issues. Well, we have to do groups through webcam now, or I have to do my therapy sessions through webcam. And a lot of people don't like that.
Right. And that is that thing that is flexibility. It's like, I don't like it,
Yes.
and also, right? It's not like,
Yep.
I don't like it and that's it, I'm not doing it. That's the rigidity that doesn't work for folks as far as evolution goes. That's really shooting yourself in the foot. I can say, you know what is real and what is true is what is in front of me and what I'm dealing with, right? And I can reject that, I can disassociate, I can compartmentalize, I can just flat out rationalize and just, pretend it doesn't exist. You know what I mean? I can do all those things. But there's going to be consequences for that, right?
Yes.
Or I can say, hey, this is just what's going on right now. It's not always been this way. It's not always going to be this way. I can fit into where it is now in the present. It's not going to fit me perfectly. It's going to be a little uncomfortable, but it's either that or I just sabotage, right? I just shoot myself in the foot because I don't like it, right? I don't like it. I mean, you think about the amount of immaturity that really is in a person's emotional journey is to just dismiss things like so rigid, such rigid thinking. That's emotional immaturity. That's not. And that's why people like, you talk to folks in their 70s and 80s, people you're willing to listen to, and they're like, God, I wish I'd have been more flexible, or I wish I would have tried that, or why was I so angry about that? Because all that stuff is just stuff that just we do look back on and think, wow, I would have done it differently because I would have flowed a lot more. I wouldn't have been so easily dismissive of things that challenged me, right? And I think that's really, I think it's the umbrella I try to live under in terms of what I do personally and professionally, and as a father and as a husband and as a colleague, is I try to remain teachable. I think that's one of the things that really stuck with me. Like, I want to be teachable. I want to be available for stuff that rocks my world. I don't want to build walls. I'll build fences, I'll build healthy boundaries, but I want them to be fences. I want to be able to see through. I want to be able to, be wrong. I want to be available. You know what I mean? Why
And I think,
not? I mean, I've learned so much. I had so much fun because of that, these last 20 years.
and do you think a lot of it has to do with like over time you gain power, you gain experience, and then that ego just develops and gets stronger and stronger, and then you have the mentality, who the hell are you to tell me this or that? That's where I think we need to focus
100%.
on.
But you think about where do we even come up with that shit, like those responses? And I've had plenty of time to think about it because I really focus on family systems, and I just try to remind folks of what they already know, but they've forgotten. It's buried underneath all the behavior and symptoms, which is really what has co-opted everything that they're doing in the system to help this person. They're not even a person anymore. They're really just a set of symptoms and behaviors. The humanification is a big trip for me, and this whole idea of dehumanization and what we do in cultures to dismiss and oppress people, it's phenomenal, man. It really is. It's something we get to look at because I think if we do, we can clearly see how we've overstepped the bounds in terms of how we do relationships with people who are struggling with the experience of addiction and mental health, is that we do this either we know we're doing it or sort of doing it unknowingly, but if you look at the results, it's not good. So it's changing our strategy to understand that these are people with stories that came from somewhere that have, rich histories where this wasn't always the case of their lives, and whatever their trajectory was, I get to appreciate it. I get to honor it, and I get to acknowledge it in a way that is not judgmental, it's not shaming, and it's not blaming, right? Because that's what people deal with from a personal standpoint, from a family standpoint, and a social standpoint. Now, this is my stigma platform, which is this whole way that we've developed going back to as far as we can remember in terms of how we've evolved to deal with people who are drug users. And by the way, alcohol is a drug, right? So
Yes.
we have state-sanctioned drugs that we're okay with, and then we have these other drugs, right? We have these demonized drugs, these
Yes.
state-sanctioned drugs that get a completely different set of rules.
Have you ever watched that Joe Rogan, right? Have you ever watched that Joe Rogan episode with Dr. Carl Hart where he talks about like what's like because they're normal drugs and what's like not okay type of drugs? Very
Yes, I
fascinating
have.
episode.
I'm a fan of Carl Hart because what he is shining the light on is what is, again, known outside of the traditional scope or channel that treatment has worked on since formalized treatment happened at Hazelden back in the whatever that year was, I can't remember, but sort of the mothership, right? Of like taking treatment and formalizing AA, which I think to me, and I want to be clear about this on the record, is that that ruined everything. That really, that whole transition from like let's professionalize this, dude, that has done irreparable damage, and that thing needs to be. That's why the former head of the NIAA, National Institute of Alcohol Abuse, I can't remember his name, but he's like, this whole industry needs to be torn down to the studs and rebuilt.
I
You
amen.
know
I
what I
agree.
mean? You know, yeah.
I mean,
Go
you
ahead.
know,
Sorry.
you've lived in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Midwest. We're severely struggling, and I don't care what anyone else says. Yes, we are. There has been an egotistical battle between LADCs and mental health professionals, just like you said, ever since. And I think we would be
Oh
better
yeah,
if we
ever
just tore everything
since.
down. I really do. I really do think.
100% because we're stuck now in this thing. It's like whether people are can articulate it or not, we're stuck. We're in this loop, man, and we're defending ourselves when we should just be like surrendering. I mean, think about all of the can you see all of the connections here between what we're teaching, but yet what we're not doing for ourselves as far as the profession? Like it's time to surrender. To and being open and being teachable and being o honest, open-minded and willing, right? From a professional standpoint to say, you know what? We can do better than this. I mean, we owe it. We owe it to people who don't have, you know, the luxury of these conversations you and I are having because they're in the trenches, struggling, going through the cycle over and over and over again, right? And getting more and more beat up, right? And you're thinking, these are the folks I work for. You know, I did for a short period of time work for a treatment center. That was in the beginning. And I was like, you know who really, treatment centers don't need more advocates. Families need more advocates.
My God, man. Like when I worked at an adolescent treatment center, I was just so conflicted because as a tech there, which again were humble beginnings for me, it would be just so. I don't know how the LADCs do it because, again, yes, I'm not blaming it all on the parents, but half the time we're taking the kids, we're teaching them these skills, and they're going back to families who have meth or who are making meth in the basement.
Dude,
And that's one, I mean, that's one of the few examples, but it happens a lot. What chance do they
yeah, of course
have?
it does. So here's, you know, in any system, and it is a system, right? Like somebody said, you know, alcoholism and addiction doesn't come in bottles and cans and baggies and pill bottles. It comes in systems because we have made it too easy for ourselves. And this is part of the hole we have to dig ourselves out of, is this whole conditioning around the war on drugs and this attitude that we have. And it is an attitude, and it is so entrenched in culture. When you've criminalized people who use drugs for 100 years, it's going to take a minute to get out from underneath. But there is nothing worth more than that effort because it is everywhere. Stigma stands in the way of everything. It stands in the way of progress. It stands in the way of clean needle programs. It stands in the way of overdose prevention sites. Stigma is this attitude towards folks. It's a way, it's again, it's dehumanization, right? Right? So stigma is a stereotype. So it's not a person, but a set of symptoms and behaviors, right? So somewhere in there is the person, but we'll get to them later. You know, we'll just manage this and we'll intervene on this and we'll set up a system that is designed at all times for this specific goal, which we know for the longest time, the standard of care or the standard of treatment has been abstinence, right? That's it.
Yes.
That is the gold standard is abstinence, and everything else is just, we don't want to even talk about it. California sober, I'll lose my mind. My head will pop off. You know what I mean? Like, I can't do that, only because I hold on so tightly. And again, this is that rigid thinking.
Yes.
And think about the things we say in AA. Whatever you hold on to so tight, you leave claw marks in. That's one. And then the other one is let go or be dragged. Well, I think this is our challenge as mental health professionals and people in treatment and people who are in this professionally. We need to heed those same warnings in the same way that we do in our personal life with our professional life, because everything has transferred over, right?
Yes.
Everything is it's the same. And it's like this thing has become something that is unhealthy because we're not willing to let go. We're not willing to evolve. We're not willing to be open-minded, honest, and willing, or remain teachable. We have decided this is the way it is, and that's it, and I don't want to talk about it.
Well, and it's kind of like you said earlier, like, get with the program and the nail that sticks out gets hammered in, right?
Right. Right. That's exactly right. This is conformity. And this is all a cultural narrative that existed for a long, 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 long time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it has its roots in capitalism. Capitalism has a very specific way of doing things. And it is all about, what can I get out of you, and what are you worth? What is the value of you as a worker? Not what is the value of you as a person, but what is the value of you as a worker or as somebody who fits into the system? If you don't fit into the system, right? So in other words, you're marginalized and oppressed if you're a child because you have no rights, right?
Yes.
Children are oppressed all over this world. They are marginalized. They are discriminated against because they have no power, because they can't produce, and they're consuming, but they're going through their parents, the older folks, to get into the consumption. So that's one, that's the, that book, part of the book in. And then the other one is old folks, right? So they lose their value. The older you get and the less you consume and produce or even work at all, right? Then you have no value then. So all that matters is the chewy nougat center.
Yes.
That's it. So this is your value. Okay. So if you and I are sucking, you know, if we're using the system or whatever, however we're being described, right? Then we are going to get less and less resources. We're going to get less and less respect. We're going to be more discriminated against, more oppressed, right? We're going to be criminalized. We're going to be sent to prison, all of these things, right? Because you're not doing it right, bro. You need to get your shit together and get out there and consume and produce, right? Otherwise, we just don't have any use for you.
Right. And you're like, once you get into the system, it's so damn hard to get out.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And then more blame, shame, and judgment.
Right.
Right. So there's plenty of that to go around consistently. So we need to figure out how to get out from underneath all of this so that we can free ourselves from this old narrative, all these normative ways of looking at people who use drugs, at least non-state sanctioned drugs. Because there's, you know, the bifurcation between legal and illegal is nonsense. It's ideologically based. There's no scientific data that proves that that's the way that this should be done. In fact, everything points to it not being the way to be doing things, because all we've done is filled our prisons. All we've done is oppressed. All we've done is keep people out of the employment loop, because if you have a record, good luck getting a job, all that stuff. And so there's a lot of inconsistencies and hypocrisy going on. All I really want to say, and what I'll keep saying, is that just like recovery, we should be open to change. We should be available to evolving. We should be available to example, right? We should be available to the example of Switzerland, to Portugal, to whoever is on the forefront of saying enough of this international drug control policy, which really only rewards the criminal element, really, while everyone else is dealing with the results of the criminal element, which is everything we just discussed. And yet they continue to profit while we're just in the trenches scraping to get by and get out, as we keep getting bashed back down because we're addicts, or, you know, we're this stereotype, we're this type of person that just doesn't seem to be able to get it together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a vicious cycle, like you said, and this is something that we need an intervention. Like I did,
right?
You know, intervention. I can appreciate an intervention, but we're not doing it right. The intervention is not working. In a moment in time, you might help people for a little bit, but for me, it's like, you know, William White talked about careers. We need to intervene on the career for each individual and figure out what capital they need in order to be successful, right? Instead of it just being one data point, we need multiple data points. We need social determinants of health. We need, that's jobs, that's education, that's housing, that's all these things that make up a life that is less stressful, that feels more secure and more safe. And we're not doing any of that. That's not, that's something you got to figure out after you get out of treatment. We can't do that shit for you. We got no dollars for that. Figure it out, get into the system, welfare, blah, 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 all this nonsense. And people get disheartened. Imagine that, right? They feel terrible. They don't feel like they got a chance. They don't feel like there's any hope. So what do you do with all that? The same thing you were doing before.
Right.
There's hope in a bottle. You know, there's hope in a syringe. There's something in there that's better than whatever I'm getting over here. All the things you said were going to come true aren't coming true, right? Because I need a job. Like I remember somebody did a survey of people through emergency rooms,
okay,
right? When they interviewed people who came through for drug and alcohol challenges, right? And when they asked them what they needed, nobody said more treatment.
Is that funny?
You know what they said they wanted?
A job.
A job. A place to live. Some food. Some love, maybe, if they could actually, you know, articulate it, right?
Right.
Some respect.
It's like the basic needs of the hierarchy of needs, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Right.
It's like, damn, a house, some food.
But if you dehumanize, then they don't fit into the same category. They don't have the same needs, right?
Yep.
I'll tell you what you need, and that is to stop using drugs. I'm sorry, but you are 1,000% wrong. You're going the wrong direction. Your premise is wrong. That is not going to do the trick. It hasn't done the trick. So,
and it gets back into our controlling mentality. You're going to do it our way. You're going to do it like this.
That's right. Drug control. And again, when I work with families, they are all about control, right? They are possessed by control, right? They're wrestling with something they can't win, right?
Right.
And so that's why they're frustrated, because nobody's giving them a way, like we're talking about from a macro perspective of how to be in relationship with folks who are using these substances or behaviors, because it's not all about substances, as you know. So addiction doesn't, it is behaviors too. And that's another thing that gets, you know, lost in translation, right? It's all about drugs. It's not. It's about what is the coping mechanism? What is the actual thing that's driving? What's the locomotive in this train? Not what's the caboose, right? We focus and obsess on the caboose, which is not the reason. That's the solution to the reason, right? Why people get run over. They're like, well, what are you going to do when you're mangled and beat up and torn apart? No job, no house, no future, no relationships. Everyone's rejected you. Society's rejecting you and judging you. I'll tell you what you do.
You go. I mean, that's a lot of them just go right to back to the bottle. It's like, this is the only thing that
you
makes
relieve
good.
The pain. Pain relief.
Yes. Amen. Yeah, that's what you do. Like, it's sad.
Yeah, it's just natural. It's because when we're talking about hierarchy of needs, one of the things everybody needs and everybody has is pain relief. Everyone has pain. Everyone has the need to relieve of it in some way, shape, or form. So this idea of somehow, as I'm judging you from up here, that I don't have any relationship with the process of having pain and needing to be relieve that pain, whether it's Bayer, Tylenol, whether it's workaholism, whether it's whatever it is, I don't even care what it is. It's something, because you're not going to sit there and go, oh, well, this pain's great. I'm not going to do anything about it.
Exactly.
I'll figure out a way. You know, and then everything else on top of that that I need as a human being to feel, you know, safe, secure, connected, you know, all those things that are the foundation that we forget, that we take for granted, a lot of us that are just built in. You know what I mean? Like, we're just like, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, what do you mean? What do I mean? You have those things. How have you ever not had them? Have you ever been stressed out because you couldn't pay for your health care, you couldn't get the right kind of health care, or you were frustrated by the system that was like didn't have time for any of your sob stories. You know, it's like, those aren't sob stories, man. Those are real life challenges and real life frustrations that are inherent in our system that need to be ironed out so that we're not all in some degree of toxic stress, you know?
Tell me what you think of this. I'm going to throw out an idea right now. And I think one of the main issues that we sometimes face too is, again, separating ourselves from, let's say, the people going through addiction. I really truly feel in my heart there's been too much of that where, and I'm sorry, sometimes a lot of the AA folks are the perpetrators of this, is that we're addicts, we stick together, the normies can't help us, whatever. And me personally, I'm not in recovery. Like, I've had family with alcoholic issues, but I personally have not. But I just think if we keep looking at that, looking at it that way and that lens, we're never going to get to the goals we really need to. I think we need to consider a lot of these issues human being issues.
Yes.
You know, like human being needs.
That's right. That's what I say, the humanification. And I didn't come up with that. There's a guy named Stanton Peel who has been an outlier in this space for many decades. You know who Stanton Peel is? Do you know him?
I've heard of him.
He's worth looking at. He's an interesting cat. I like him because, again, he's like, you know, he's bucking the system. He's calling people out. He's very vocal. He's got a different style than me, but he wants people to listen. So he can be a little hyperbolic, but sometimes that's like how you get people's attention. Right. Exactly.
What's his name?
Stanton, Stanton, Peel, Peele.
All right.
William White, Stanton Peel. Those guys are good folks to know. John Kelly at Harvard. He's got a website called recoveryanswers.org, I think it is. If you look up John Kelly Recovery Answers, this is all data and research ongoing. I think it's out of Harvard. You know, John Hopkins has its own Stigma Lab, which is really interesting. So they're going deep on this whole idea of what we need to know from a scientific basis and research basis and data, how impactful stigma is, even if you know, some people just need all that, and that's good. I'm glad for that. So there's a lot of really good things going on out there where people are sort of outside the box. Harm reduction has obviously gotten macro attention now from the administration, from the White House, which is a long time coming. We had Michael Botticelli, who is a guy in long-term recovery and was in the Office of Drug Policy under Obama. And is outspoken about stigma and about change. And even Nora Volkla, who is the director of the National something of something, I can't remember, but she's been in this position. It's a place that gets $1 billion in funding, right? A billion, okay? And hasn't really moved the needle. Okay, so this is very frustrating. When you're talking about trying to help folks and you're getting $1 billion, but you're not really impacting it like we should, if you've got that much cash, where is it all going? And why haven't we, she's starting to change a little bit. She's very entrenched in the establishment, but she's starting to change a little bit. So she's really interesting in more present time. And I think that's come from the pandemic has upset things and shined a light on things that maybe people hadn't necessarily seen. Another person is Maya Sazalovitz, and she's a writer, a researcher around addictive issues, and she's really great. There's a lot of folks out there beating the drum. Filter is a great, I don't know if you know about Filter. Filter is dedicated to highlighting these issues and reporting on them, whether it's harm reduction, anything in politics, stuff worldwide in terms of what people are doing. That's a great resource to kind of figure out what's going on in the fringes, not in just sort of the same old stuff, different day. I really like those guys. So there's a lot of places to go to get another sort of viewpoint. And I think, you know, we're really coasting on confirmation bias in this space, right? And confirmation bias is that all I'm interested, it's what happens within AA, and it's what happens within the treatment paradigm, where it's like I decide what my premise is, and then I go and look for data to back it up.
Right.
Right. So I kind of back my way into it instead of going, why aren't things working? Let's go and see where people are doing research and what they've found out about different ways to address this. It's really just let me look at what confirms what I already believe.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what 270 meetings will do to you. You know, it really helped me. But at the same time, as I continued to learn sort of outside of the rooms, there was this conflict, there was this friction going on. And that's really what led me to, you know, first of all, have one foot in AA and one foot out of, and then to completely sort of go out 100% and get committed to understanding in context what I had learned, you know, what could be different in terms of just teaching people about AA. I still tell my story. I still appreciate that time, but there's context to it now, and there's understanding of some nuance, right? Because everything has nuance. I think that's another art, a lost art in our culture, is nuance, right? Mm-hmm. Is the color gray, as people like to say, you know? So, you know, I think that's where we can really start to figure out how to heal. Maybe we're struggling in in the conformity of AA and the sort of, you know, not a lot of space in there. Although originally that's what it was intended for. I mean, if you look at the original text, if you look at I have the book that has all of the notes for Bill and Bob in terms of how they came up with ultimately what the text says in the big book. Mm-hmm. And they wrestled with a lot of stuff. And I think that's really important that we know that, that they knew, and Bill knew in all his writings later on after, you know, he couldn't even get into his own groups. You know what I mean? They were like, oh, Bill, you can't come here. You take LSD. Like, we can't have you, you know, as the leader of our group, you know? It's like,
that's believe it or not, that's still very debatable till today. Some people are trying to deny that he actually did that and this and that.
Right. I mean, this is the extremists. They're always going to be like, you know, don't mess with my stuff, man. Don't you touch my stuff.
No, he was an interesting character. I heard he was into some shit too. So seances. Have you ever heard he tried doing some seances?
He was a seeker. The reason one that he created that was because he's always been a seeker, because he's always struggled. He's always like, why do I feel this way? Why am I depressed? Mm-hmm. Why can I not get, you know, he wrote a great thing about emotional sobriety called The Final Frontier. It's an amazing article about what he learned about himself and what was part of the root of his depression was his inability to, it was basically Buddhism. He was so attached to these constructs that it caused him suffering. He didn't have any room for anything else to be true. You know what I mean? And that can be the root of depression, is that you don't see another way. You only you're stuck, right? You're underneath what I would suggest are beliefs, right? And these beliefs can be very oppressive. We know that. That's how it works. So I love his spirit is the reason why AA was created. And it's interesting that all the stuff that came after that, including the LSD, including, you know, the niacin was another thing, right? That he looked a lot into, was using niacin for supplements, right? That's a supplement, right? So he was always looking for a way. And I think I'm really emulating that. You know, when I read his biography, you know, the lady who wrote his had them all the most clearance for all of the stuff that was in the library, you know, and she went through it all. And it's an amazing book because it teaches you again about context and not to stay so rigid and to be open. Right. That's what we need. That's what we need in all of our systems. We need to figure out how to be a little more open-minded.
So, let's go back. When did he take that LSD? Did he take it when he was in the hospital and he had that?
Well, that was the experience? First. That's belladonna. So that was first. That was something. Belladonna is psychoactive something, right?
And
that was his spiritual experience.
But that's fear. That puts fear in people, like, because the
right.
What's the cause? Exactly. Like, wait, he had to use a substance to get sober. No, we don't get sober that way. No, like,
well, guess what? Here it comes again, right? Now we have psychedelics are coming back, and a meta study just came out about, and it just literally 2 days ago, right?
Yep.
Where they were talking about, you know, this double blind and this, you know, the 160 and the, I mean,
it's crazy.
Again, I have been studying this for years. So this is like not new to me. I've been talking to people about, look, dude, you need to just go do a hero's dose because you are so
Yes.
stuck in your fucking loop. You're not going to be able to pray your way out of it. You are just,
Right.
you are on a hamster wheel. And I was like, and I was saying that stuff when I was, a long time ago, I'm reading about ayahuasca and all of the different medicines and the plant medicines. And now you have, Change Your Mind on Netflix, which was, that guy, which I can't think, Tom something, I think it is, did, the main psychedelics, even.
I freaking tried to email that guy. I'm still waiting.
Yeah,
I want to get, because I've been doing a couple episodes on actually that kind of stuff. You should check out.
yeah,
But yeah,
so I
I'm totally in
microdose
that.
psychedelics. I microdose
Okay.
psychedelics as a way to work my way. And I've already done Hero's Dose. I did that many years ago
I
recreationally.
want to
So,
try that. I actually really want to try that.
yeah, so that's coming. And then the therapeutic aspect of it is
Yep.
this idea of how do we do this in a controlled way that says, here's the
Yes.
data we have at the beginning, and we have it all, lined up, and then we put people through this, and then we are able to talk about it afterwards and process,
Yes.
and then see what kind of like in the show, right? Like the guy who had OCD and the soldier with the trauma, the PTSD and all that. This dude is so exciting because I've lost so many people who get stuck in the loop
I
because they
know.
can't get out of the vortex of what is what considered the way you do it, the way.
Yes.
It's so religious. You think about it, the way. The only way to salvation is this way.
That reminds me of someone who's like, let's say, has good amount of sobriety time, but they're like white knuckling it the whole time and they're miserable.
Yes, right. And there is some anecdotal evidence of people, especially men, with long-term what I call stark raving sobriety,
Yep. I know many of them.
who commit suicide because there is no other way. And that's interesting because in the book itself it says seek outside help, but we have developed this thing that is that's even become something that isn't widely accepted or acknowledged, right? It's actually in the text, right? So that's the other thing that gets very scary about this because, we're talking about life or death here for somebody who hasn't addressed their
Yes.
acute trauma, right? And their inability to hang on anymore. And so you have men with 40 years don't think there's any way and don't talk about it because it's just not, it's not available. It's not allowed, so to speak, right? And you know what? Even in the general population is the reason why men commit suicide at a higher rate is because that is a normal cultural norm of men. It's the man rules. It's like,
Be
don't let him,
strong.
don't, yes. Don't let people see you sweat, keep it to yourself, keep your chin up, all
Yes.
that stuff.
Oh, it's
So
brutal.
anyway, so it's brutal. It's brutal to the point where, we're devastating people's lives and families with this nonsense. So that's becoming more and more we're seeing, which is great. We're seeing more people with a big platform, like celebrities, like Jonah Hill just came out and said, you won't see me promoting my films, my current or any of my future films, because it creates so much anxiety in me that I feel like I might not be able to survive it. So he's made that call. Tom Holland did the same. Spider-Man came out and talked, and many people have. So that's good. This is good because they're able to articulate it. That generation
Exactly.
is able to articulate it in a way that's really powerful. So I'm really happy about those kinds of advances, where people are willing to, because what people told me 20 years ago, who were saying, we need to talk about this, and
Yes.
anonymity is, you can tell people you're an AA. You just can't tell people that I am, right? That's also confusing. People don't understand that.
Yeah.
My anonymity is my business. Your anonymity is your business. If I violate, I can say I'm an AA, no problem, at
Right.
the level of press, radio, and film. I just can't say you are,
Exactly.
right? And so by our silence, others define us. And that's been the pathway for people who are experiencing addiction and mental health or emotional health
Right.
issues, is that we've stayed silent, so the rest of it, everybody else fills in the blanks for us and says, we're this, we're that, we're violent, we're dangerous, we're unpredictable, we're this stereotype,
Yep.
right? And that's And here we are. Here we are trying to
Exactly,
fight all
man.
that and get rid of it and to blow it up. And that's what I want to see in my lifetime. I want to see it reach such a level like cancer did, because cancer went through that too, which is interesting. It was the C word. People used to say it with, like, they'd whisper it that somebody had cancer, which is really interesting. And now, you know, we have telephones and we have all this stuff, and that has changed. And I want to see that for the experience of addiction and mental health, where we have telephones for this shit.
Exactly.
Like, and we have them every year, and we have them multiple times a year. And now it's all, even the advocacy is steeped in stigma, because the premise is still wrong. You know, and we're not talking about the elephant in the room, and that is our belief that drugs are bad. And that categorically, that's still where we live. We live in this idea that drugs need to be controlled. And that's the reason why it's taken so long to even the few states that we have to legalize cannabis, right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. It,
right, exactly.
The amount of it, oh my God, dude, the damage that it's done to people is just, oh, heartbreaking, heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Psychedelics, there's a guy in jail in Arizona for life, for dealing psychedelics.
That's
He got completely, it was a whole sting operation. That fucking kid is like wasting away in jail. I mean, it's like.
That's just bullshit.
It's brutal, man. It's brutal. It's brutality. It's, I don't know, man. It's really hard to see that kind of stuff still go on.
It's horrible.
Because these are just kids' lives ruined. Ruined.
Yeah, and it goes back to, like, what are we doing here? What's the big picture? Like,
the big picture is you know, there's things that we get to address. That's patriarchy, that's puritanism, that this notion of the religiosity that still permeates our culture, this idea of virtue, right? Virtue is big, right? People with virtue don't do drugs. Oh, really? Well, they don't tell you they do, but they do.
Yep.
Right? So don't be confused, you know. So it's all of this sort of surface stuff. Again, it's really interesting, because as long as we stay on the surface, right, at the apex, at the tip of the iceberg, we never get to what's we can't see below, or that nobody wants to talk about. So that's our challenge, is to get below the tip and say, look, we need to look at all this ugliness how kind of we've categorized it, instead of just looking at it as things that we can address and overcome and repurpose and reimagine. It's so much baggage that it's overwhelming for folks. You know, it is individually people who are struggling. So why wouldn't it be culturally and socially, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we need to all just talk about it and say, if we keep doing the same thing over again, we're going to get the same result. If nothing changes, nothing changes. If we don't have an open mind, we're going to be here in a year, and more people are going to die unnecessarily or suffer unnecessarily. If we won't call out the boogeyman for what it is, which it isn't a boogeyman, it's just how we've identified, then we can't get past it. If we don't call it out, if somebody doesn't get strong enough and courageous enough to call bullshit, right? More and more people, right?
That's it.
To say enough is enough is enough, right? And the outcomes speak for themselves. Yes. We have failed in our drug control policy, to the tune of $2.5 trillion, approximately. So why are we willing to let that go? But we're not willing to let it go that if Michigan doesn't beat Ohio State.
Oh, wow, yep.
Right? Like, our priorities are out of whack. Like, we're willing to do whatever it takes to win this war, this battle. But over here, it doesn't seem like we are. We're not willing to do it. We're not willing to go to look and open the closet at our dirty laundry and say, this is what we've really messed up, and this is how we can finally rectify it. And you know what I mean? I'll kind of finish with this, because I work for those folks who aren't ever going to see their lives matter, because they were treated in such a way that made them feel like it didn't. Right?
It's like,
that made them
the
feel
voice.
Less than.
We have a voice for the people that don't.
I owe them. That's who I work for.
Amen.
That they deserve it, because they didn't get an opportunity to shake the stigma themselves, and their families didn't either. And they deserve, you know, their life mattered, whether they did drugs or not. That's not what we need to let to decide is whether or not they're worthy of something or not is drug use. That's just nonsense. And so I work for those folks and their families and the ones that are left behind and still grieving. Right. And I just, you know, anybody out there who is dealing with this sort of sitting on the, they're in purgatory themselves because whatever they went through or still going through isn't working, right? And they're unsure, they're in uncertainty, which is a scary place to be. Just know that beyond that veil of uncertainty are people working really hard for you to be able to find a pathway that works for you so that you can get out of this repeat mode, this cycle, because you don't think you're doing it right, right? And everyone's telling you that, right? Like it's your fault, okay? It's not, right? It's responsibility without blame. You can live in that paradigm. That is a good place to live because you didn't choose addiction. Nobody chooses that, right? And there's a whole thing on the other side of this curtain that seems like that's as far as you can go. There's a lot of room in there for you to figure out your specific style and way of addressing your trauma and your sadness and your pain and your despair. So don't worry about that. We're there. We're here. And, you know, I just think that's important for folks to know.
Very beautifully said, man. And man, again, it's been such an honor and pleasure having you on the show. I had a lot
Thank
of fun,
you.
Man. We got
me too. I'm stuff. Jazzed. I'm fired up.
I'm stimulated right now.
Right, I'm ready to go.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, hey, if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there like an email or LinkedIn or anything they could use to send you a message or whatnot?
Yeah, I think it's go to sustainablerecovery.net, and that's sort of a portal you can go through and you can get my email and my phone number, and there's a lot of resources and there's some hope on my pages. Yep. And there's some links on that front page there that'll take you to family stuff and take you to some other stuff. But what I really built those things for was not to like capture people and profit, but for places where people could go to look at resources and see a different way of looking at things.
Yeah.
So that they could kick up some more hope, because a lot of people, and I just got off a call with a family who were like, we're done. And I've heard that so many times.
Yeah.
They're tired. They're done. And I said, you know what? I understand that, but that's because you've been pushing shit up. Basically,
yeah.
I'm like, you've not been given the tools that free you up to really be effective as a caregiver and as a parent and as a mother, brother, sister, lover. You've been painted into a corner that makes you more and more tired and more angry.
Yep.
And I'm like, you don't have to do that anymore. And they're like, what are you talking about? Like, what?
Exactly.
They don't believe it, man. They're like, they're just beat up. They're tore up from the floor up, just like their kid is, right? You know? And so I just want people to know there's hope. You don't have to keep going down the same road, taking you to the same place that doesn't give you the results you want.
Amen. Amen, man. Well, again,
The website will get you to, you know, I'm happy to talk to anybody complimentary for 50 minutes about how I can jazz you and get you hopeful again.
And I will make sure I put those links on the show notes too. For when,
thanks,
so it'll be one click away.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you for inviting me on, man. I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure.
I again just want to thank Tim for an awesome and amazing episode. I've learned so much, as well as my listeners have. I also want to inform everyone that the content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.